Welcome back to Real Science Radio. I'm Fred Williams here with Doug McBurney, and we're continuing our conversation with Dr. Thomas Dykstra. Last week, we talked about regenerative agriculture, government buzzwords, and why Dr. Dykstra prefers a clearer goal, nutrient density. So let's resume from there. Can two similar-looking carrots actually have very different nutritional value? Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune into Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Actually, seriously, are you willing to submit a definition of regenerative agriculture for consideration?
I would not submit one. The reason why is because I am absolutely in love with nutrient density. I like it. It makes sense to me. If this is the goal, everyone seems to understand what density means. Unless, of course, you've watched a Back to the Future movie. In that case, you might be a little bit confused about the whole density thing. Some people are getting that joke. Other people are not. But nutrients, people understand nutrient, too. So nutrient density makes sense to me. If that's the goal, is to make our food more nutrient dense, then that is a goal that is clear in my mind. I don't need regenerative agriculture. Now, it just so happens that organic agriculture also has usually sometimes a similar goal of nutrient density. So most of the time I'm supportive of the organic agriculture movement. But I also know is that based upon the fact that I do test Brix levels, that sometimes organic food is not as high a Brix as I would like it to be. And so therefore I'm not as behind organic agriculture. But nutrient density I love. So I've got something that I like. Why would I throw the baby out with the bathwater here? I'm perfectly fine with talking about nutrient density. I think all the listeners understand that, at least at some level right now, is that you simply have a higher density of nutrition and stop, period. You know, I'm not having another 15 to 20 markers and like additionally what nutrient density is. Yeah. It's simply about increasing the density of your food. And if that's the goal, there are several ways, many ways that we can do that. That's why I'm not interested in putting forward a definition of regenerative agriculture, to your disappointment.
Well, so are you implying that regenerative agriculture may merely be the Taylor Swift of 2024 in 2026? Is Taylor Swift over yet? I don't want to make a bad social. Is she over?
Who? Taylor who?
Taylor Swift. Oh, no, I did it. I'm bad at this. Who is it? Maybe I even got the wrong name.
No. I know you got the right name.
So is it possible that regenerative agriculture is like something like that?
Regenerative agriculture is the thing. This is the thing everyone gets behind. This is the code word that everyone puts in. There's clean water. There's regenerative agriculture. These are the words you put in. So it's the thing right now. And because it's big, it's not going to stop anytime soon. I absolutely see this going on. It's been going on for a few years. It will go on for a few years more. I'm just saying, as a scientist, I cannot get behind it because it is not clear to me. And we scientists, we either like clarity or we pretend to like clarity. It's one of the two, depending upon the mood of the scientist at that particular moment. So because of that, I'm not in the mood in order to support regenerative agriculture unless someone gives me a definition that just causes me to go, wow, that's it. I'm behind this. This is wonderful. This is fantastic. Because sometimes I do see nutrient density in the definitions. Other times it's left out. I wouldn't leave it out at all because I think it's important enough to be included. And anytime you're talking about food, we should be talking about nutrient density. But because it's left out and it's put in, these are sometimes just code words for getting implicit approval of something. And therefore, I'm just not on board. Just not.
Well, so speaking of nutrient density, I want to see if my co-host is nutrient dense. So I want to do the interesting fact of the week. Are you ready, Doug?
Well, Fred, I have been called dense.
I knew that joke was coming. Oh, it was saw that a mile away, Doug.
It's just a, it was a, like a big fat softball hanging out there. What can you do?
So. Okay, so here is the interesting fact of the week. What can you hold in one teaspoon that contains more living organisms than there are people on Earth? And I see my our guest is smiling. I'm sure he knows.
All right. In a teaspoon, let's see, there's like 7, approaching 8 billion. Have we passed 8 billion people on Earth? Maybe.
Yeah.
Very close.
We have.
In one teaspoon.
One teaspoon.
So are you talking about the teaspoon in my drawer, or are you talking about an actual teaspoon that I measure when I cook?
The cooking teaspoon.
Okay. They're the same for all of you who are wondering right now.
Yeah, let's clear that up now.
That changes things dramatically. Let me redo my math here. Okay, Fred, I'm going to say human saliva.
Not quite.
Darn.
So, Dr. Dykstra, do you want to take a crack at that one?
I'm going to take a crack, though, but I'm going to qualify it. It's going to be some types of soil. Not all types of soil, but some. Yeah,
so according to the USDA, United States Department of Agriculture, healthy soil has all kinds of living organisms.
Wow. Healthy soil. I'm glad you mentioned the healthy, because dead soil doesn't have it.
Yeah. So not just plain old dirt.
Wow.
Or clay. Healthy soil.
Okay.
All right.
So anyway, that must be all a part of the symbiotic ecosystem that causes the nutrient-dense food to grow that we need to eat and all of that. It's almost as if it was all really well planned.
Big words. Did you hear the big words, Fred, that Doug was throwing out at you right
impressive.
Now?
Yeah.
That was.
He's trying to recover. Yes.
Now, you mentioned the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and so since we have addressed some public policy issues, I just want everyone to know that the program that we mentioned, it will be distributed. I wanted to make sure that if there were any farmers listening, that they knew exactly where to go in order to sign up for the program.
This is a government form that needs to be filled out. This is not going to be a single page. This is easily going to be 5 to 10 pages that you'll have to fill out. It will then have to be reviewed by someone in the government, and then they will approve it. And they will send you your $200 after filling out 5 to 10 pages of forms that you will finally get after it's been successfully reviewed over 2 months and has gone through 15 to 17 different eyes at the USDA. And then with that $200, you are going to completely change your farming operation. Did I just sum it up okay?
You did. You left out one part. Hey, honey, would you like to go to Saltgrass Steakhouse tonight?
Yes.
Yeah, please. Hey, fill out this form, and we'll have more than enough for a nice meal.
It's date night tonight. Yeah.
All right. And so if you're tempted, if you just can't resist getting involved in what the good doctor just described, you'll want to make sure you check in with the Department of Agriculture and look for the Environmental Quality Incentives Program and or the Conservation Stewardship Program, which being streamlined, as so many things are now in the Trump administration, you now have the ability to combine several applications in here, bundle multiple regenerative practices applications into a single application. And this will be translated into Somali for anyone in Minnesota who is interested in signing up. We just want you to know that.
Oh, the $9 billion jokes just keep coming. They just keep coming.
Nothing compared to what we put on the skids and sent over to Iran with President Obama. I mean, that was real money. This is a drop in the bucket. But I appreciate you reminding our audience that even though 700 million, that's less than a billion, which I may be dating myself. I can't remember exactly when this was said, but I think it was in the 80s, which is now a long time ago.
Yeah.
But a senator or a congressman said, hey, a billion here, a billion there, and pretty soon you're talking about real money. And that was in the 80s before we even knew what a trillion was. Yeah. I had never heard of a trillion back then.
Yeah.
So this might be a small amount of money, but we know that the amount of money does not, should not impact our moral obligation to do right.
Yep. So and we appreciate back to you nutrient density.
That. Yes,
so,
nutrient density.
So I eat a lot of carrots. I like the baby carrots. Sometimes you get the ones that are cut from a real carrot. I mean, I guess baby carrots are too, but so can two carrots look the same, Dr. Dykstra, but have totally different nutrient density?
It's yes and no. The answer is yes and no. So many people have difficulty telling the difference between them, but there are certain indicators, visual indicators, that will tell you, and that is the deep color of the carrot will usually mean that there are more secondary plant metabolites, more carotenoids and others. And so if you walk into a store and you see a dark orange carrot and then you see a light orange carrot, you can pretty much be rest assured that the dark orange carrot is going to have more nutrition in it, and it almost certainly will. However, in order to start differentiating between other dark orange carrots and other light orange carrots, sometimes it's nice to pull out the Brix refractometer, which I would use in order to test it, to see what kind of nutrition we are getting in there, because that's going to give me a more healthy indicator of how much nutrition through sugar is in it. Because the more sugar in a plant, that's all photosynthesis. The more sugar that's in a plant, the healthier it's going to be. And so we can bring this into a store if we wanted to. Produce manager is probably not going to like it. Or you could just buy the stuff, bring it at home and measure it as well. And that will give you a better idea about the nutrient density of what you are looking to buy. So, yeah.
So at Dykstra Laboratories, are you selling like this Brix device? I mean, you probably make a fortune, right? I'd probably get one, take it to the store. I mean, remind our audience this whole Brix thing.
I don't sell anything here at the laboratory. Okay. So, although I should tell you this, how much money could I make if I had done that? I think the answer is probably quite a bit, because refractometer, you couldn't find it for much less than $100 many years ago. Then I started talking about Brix. The price started coming down.
You know
what's happening now. It got down to $60 to $70. And then the price kept coming down. It was in the $20 range. People during my talks were getting on Amazon and doing searches on Amazon and saying that they're in the $20 to $25 range. And as I'm talking to you right now, I know that Amazon will sell one for $17. So this only happens when you're selling a lot of refractometers. So if I had been, you know, buying stock in the refractometers, I'd probably be doing pretty well right now. So I don't sell any of that stuff. That's not what I do. But I do know that a lot of refractometers are being sold based upon the fact that the price is coming down, 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 and is now down as low as $17. Does that answer your question, Fred?
It mostly does, yeah. Now, this Brix scale, does this refractometer, does it like tell you what that is? And is it like a scanner that you can take in the store? How does that thing work?
Yeah, what you usually do is we squeeze. So we can squeeze the plant substance. Squeezing a carrot root is difficult to do. We often do it with a garlic press. If we don't have a garlic press, I've got a plant sap press, which is a little bit more heavy duty, and we can squeeze the juice out of it. So if we squeeze the juice out of a leaf, squeeze the juice out of a root, squeeze the juice out of a stem, squeeze the juice out of a lot of different things, you will get some liquid that you put on the refractometer. You press the button, at least for the digital one, and you get an answer within about 2 seconds. And that will give you a number, a hard Brix reading. Let's just say it's at, you know, 13.2. So it's a 13.2 Brix reading, and that tells me that it's healthier than something that comes in at a 7.9 Brix.
Okay.
Okay.
And so wait a second. That's not the $17 job, not the digital one where you push the button.
Yeah, the digital one's more expensive. Being the dumb scientist, I do like exactness, and
yeah,
you can get exactness when you have the digital model. So I spent $300 for mine. Right now, the digital ones, the good digital ones, are probably just over 100 right now. because I got mine over 20 years ago. So you can get a nice, clean digital model, and that I think you'll be happy with. Yeah,
but it's not like a thing like for your when you take your temperature on your forehead. You have to squeeze the leaf.
You do. You have to squeeze whatever it is you wish to test. So,
okay,
if you log
make
into
sure the produce manager isn't around when you're doing this at store, right?
Absolutely. This gets this raises suspicions when you're doing that. They'll think like, "Are you from another store? What's going on?" But I can guarantee you, if you mention that you're doing Brix testing, he'll probably recognize it and he'll know exactly what you are doing and exactly what you are trying to do.
Yeah. So security aisle 5.
No, yes. No. You could end up making a new friend. I mean, how many produce managers would love to talk about produce? I mean, it's pretty much their life. So you could end up with a brand new friend. And so, Doctor, I have to thank you for helping our audience recognize, and this is the beauty of life, is that the truth comes across and you don't really have to try. So what you just described about the refractometer and the price over the past 20 years, this is why we need humans instead of human services. So Dr. Dykstra goes around the country. He talks about Brix along with other people talking about nutrition, making people aware of what's going on. This ends up driving an industry to produce devices that can facilitate people's desires. Mm-hmm. And the price of a very pricey piece of equipment within a relatively short period of time, although nobody mandated it, nobody tried, nobody said this has to happen, it just happens. Now you've got multiple manufacturers making different levels and quality and accuracy of these refractometers to measure Brix.
All true.
And so this is how the free market works, children. We don't need the state to step in and tell us what to do. We need to all seek to know the truth and to do what's right. And if we were all to do that, the market would be moral and just and righteous, and it would do good. And we'd have more humans and fewer human services. Anyway, all right. So I don't want to start preaching and get on my...
You just did, Doug.
So listen, so exactly, seeing as I asked you for a definition before and you do have a PhD, can you define for me a human service?
I don't think so. That might be above my pay grade, Mr. McBurney. So, because I'm a scientist right now, I cannot offer a definition on that particular term. Therefore, I'm going to pass. So, okay. I'm an entomologist and not a biologist. So, because I'm not a biologist, I'm not going to be able to answer that question. So, thank you for asking, but I'm just going to give you the finger right now.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I've got a memo out to Taylor Swift's manager try to help me with that particular definition. But you did say earlier, again, without even trying, how bureaucrats tend to leave a little bit of fudge room in almost everything. And so what better operation than to get to Washington and set up an entire department that nobody can define? We got a Department of Human Services. Nobody even knows what they are. And $700 billion, that's like what they spend on the
$700 million.
I'm sorry. Yep. $700 million, that's not even the toilet paper at the Department of Health and Human Services. So that's just, that's brilliant. But you mentioned you're an entomologist, which by the way, it's ento. E-N-T-O-mology. Do you have any idea about the etymology of entomology?
I do. It's actually a Latin group, and you are incorrect. So I'm going to correct you right now, much to the delight of Fred. The Latin term is actually... the Latin term is entome, E-N-T-O-M.
Oh,
so that's the actual insect part of it. It's the ology. It's not the mology. It's the ology, which signifies the study of, and it's the study of insects. And so that's where entomology comes from. That's the root for it. Sometimes we have Greek roots in science. Other times we have Latin roots. This one just happens to be a Latin root.
Okay. And so since we're on the subject, and I know that this has been on the minds of many of our viewers and even more of our radio listeners, because they tend to skew a little older. What's the difference between entomology and nematology?
Okay. Nematology is a study of nematodes. Nematodes, sometimes called nematodes, depending upon where you are in the world and your preference. Nematology, that's the study of nematodes, and these are roundworms. They are not insects. They don't have six legs. These are small worms that exist. A lot of them exist in the soil, and they are eating. How about this? I'm just going to tilt this full circle right now. A lot of the nematodes or nematodes eat those billions of microbes in that teaspoon of soil. How did I do, Fred?
That was good. Awesome. Now is that awesome. is that a good thing that they're chowing down on those things, or is that not good?
Yeah, it's fine. It's nice to have a true ecology going on in the soil. So you've got small organisms, you have large organisms, the large ones eat the small ones. It's all good. It's all the food chain, so it's fine. It's fine.
Wow.
Okay.
So there's an entire field of study that has developed around the roundworm.
You better believe it.
Wow.
You better believe it. Now, it's not as big as entomology, but it is out there. And so there are a few nematology groups, or at the University of Florida, it's called the Entomology and Nematology Department. So they actually bring them together rather than having a separate department. Some universities do not have a staff nematologist. Others have a few, which means you might say that there's a nematology group there. And as far as the University of Florida is concerned, we've actually got them in the name of our entomology department. So they've all got different degrees as to how it is approached. It's not as big as the bugs, although some people may consider them bugs. They're just worms. It is big enough in order to have scientists devoted to this subject matter.
So does this play into like soil quality? You know, we're talking about bricks and all this, and good crops and bad crops and organic food. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious if, these insects and non-insects, whatever what were they called? Nematodes.
Yeah. Any pronunciation, tomato, tomato, whatever you want to do is fine with me.
So we're told to, you know, in Genesis that we're to tend the garden. And so I'm wondering, can we get into like how that could matter to the backyard gardener if he wants to have really good looking green peppers, tomatoes, et cetera? How does this handle
it? It should matter, because you do want a healthy ecosystem in the soil. You want the microbes in there, which include a lot of the bacteria. You want the protozoa in there, which are eating some of the bacteria. You want the nematodes in there, which are eating a lot of different things, including the protozoans, the bacteria. You've also got larger organisms. You have earthworms. You have pseudoscorpions. You've got lots of mites in the soil. When all of these are in the soil and you've got that much life in the soil, that is considered to be healthy. They're eating one another. And this system works because, you know what happens when you eat? Eventually you poop. And so a lot of this poop coming out the back end of, you know, the bacteria, the nematodes, the earthworms, sometimes it just escapes through the skin. Sometimes they poop it out. But the fact is, we've got processing going on. And this processing creates food sources in the soil, which leads to healthy soil. And it's the healthy soil that has all of these life forms in it that Fred so eloquently put when he asked the question that Doug was unable to answer.
So do we go out and buy a bunch of yogurt and put it in our garden, you know, pour out, you know, how do you get,
you have no idea how closely you just hit. I mean, that is amazing that you said that. We do have, there's a new study out right now, which is showing that there's a lactobacillus plantarum, which is now known to break down glyphosate, which is that weed killer, that herbicide, which is out there. So because of that, lactobacillus plantarum was taken from sauerkraut, and this sauerkraut was now showing that you could actually severely reduce the glyphosate herbicide in the soil at a very rapid rate. So we had always wondered, how could you actually break down the glyphosate into the soil? And recently, I mean, this is probably only a few years old, so it was probably just coming out at the time we last spoke. maybe a year ago, but it is now relatively established. And so you actually hit the nail on the head because you could take the yogurt, go out there, which will include several forms of lactobacillus. They may not actually have lactobacillus plantarum, but they may have some others. And these lactobacillus bacteria are beneficial in the soil. So this is amazing, Fred, that you just accidentally stumbled across this truth. And so here we have Doug struggling over there, and you are just speaking off the cuff and nailing it. So,
well, this is, no, listen, this is, Fred is making my point that Fred is actually working for me. He's making my point that we need more humans and fewer human services, because when humans interact, these things happen. I personally believe that the fact that human beings can recognize irony and serendipity are proof that we are spiritual beings, that we're created by God, and we're not just a collection of, that's just one of the further proofs, as if we needed any more. The fact that we can recognize these things, and that we have these organic discussions that produce beneficial, valuable information. Like you just talked about sauerkraut.
Yeah.
So I just want to tell you that struck very close to home, because I grew up in the Buffalo, New York area in the early 1970s, and sauerkraut, if I remember correctly, we ate sauerkraut 3 times a week. When I went to school and learned about the however many food groups, I was shocked that sauerkraut was not one of them. But little did I know that my mother was preparing my gut for longevity. And again, she wasn't even trying. She wasn't supplying a human service.
Yeah.
She was supplying sauerkraut from a human. It's all just a beautiful, you speak about an ecosystem. I feel like we should all hold hands and there should be a rainbow over us right now. That's how good this all feels, Doctor.
Wonderful. I'm so glad you're touched.
Yeah. No.
Are you going to go out and get a Reuben sandwich now? Please say
no,
yes.
There you go.
I love Reuben sandwiches.
Oh, I love Reuben sandwiches too.
I always ask for extra sauerkraut.
Oh, I'm with you. Sometimes I'm eating a Reuben sandwich, especially when I'm traveling, and I'm thinking, they need more sauerkraut here. I'm going to need a little bit more flavor. Yeah.
Yes. Well, so that's what sauerkraut was intended for.
For Reuben sandwiches. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. It was not intended to be a side dish with every other meal. Yeah. But what could I say? I wasn't paying for the food back then, and there was a lot of inflation back in the 70s. We all remember that. Now, Doctor. We don't all remember that, as a matter of fact. Half the audience doesn't remember the 70s, but we'll leave that. I cannot let you go, Doctor, and we are going to run out of time, as we always do, before we're ready. I cannot let you go without asking you about a problem that I brought up to Fred a month or so ago, right here where I live. This is a talk about hitting home. My next-door neighbor has honeybees. Now, honeybees, those are a part of the entomological field, am I correct?
You are correct.
It's possible you could help me with this, because we were worried about our neighbor's honeybees. He doesn't live there. It's a vacant property. He set up his bees, and then he lives 50 miles away. He visits them once a week. So we have the honeybees next door, which we're fine with. Or we were fine. Anyway, but we worried about them because they would show up on our doorstep, and they look like they're drunk. They're staggering around. They're not really flying. They're on the ground, which bees, they shouldn't be on the ground. As far as we know, they should be flying around. So we thought maybe the bees have problems. And then recently, the bees turned violent. They attacked me twice, bit me 5 times one time.
Stung me.
I appreciate that. I should know that too, because my daughter was picking the stingers out of my flesh. And hey, I'm a tough guy. I can deal with all that. But things have escalated because they stung my wife. And now we got trouble. I don't want to go to war with my neighbors. Can you tell me what's going on, or maybe give me some advice on what I could do?
Okay, buy a shotgun, start taking out the bees one by one, get a lot of ammunition. There's probably going to be about 60,000 bees in a colony at a time if it's full grown. What could be going on? If you get a lot of bees that are out there kind of staggering around and lost, and I don't know what's going on, you could be dealing with a whole bunch of drones. So the honeybees, when they're done with the drones, which are the male honeybees, when they're done with them, they kick them all out. They're only there during a certain time of the year. They have only one function. I'm not going to mention what that function is because right now I'm trying to keep this below a PG-13 rating right now. So because you have the drones, which have only one function, when they're done, they're tossed and they get thrown out of the colony. And oftentimes you will find a large number of drones kind of staggering around the colony very close by, probably within 20 to 25 feet, sometimes a little bit further. They're aimless. They're lost. They don't know what to do. They're not being fed anymore by the worker honeybees, which are all female. So that's a possibility. I may not be right, but I'm just saying that is one of the possibilities that you could be dealing with. So if you are curious as to whether or not it's true or not, you can pick up these drones in your finger and stick it on your hand and start squeezing it. If it doesn't sting you, it's a drone.
Oh, that's
but if it does sting you, sorry.
So, Doug, are you going to try that? You just said you were really tough.
Yeah, you did. You did.
Well, I've already survived five stings, and the last
time those weren't drones, then, right?
Yeah, well, they're not drones. Drones don't have stingers.
No, it wasn't the drunk ones that bit me. That's why we've never really had any issue with the bees, is because they all look like they're drunk and they can't fly, and they were harmless. But I was digging a trench for some drainage, and boy, they didn't seem to like that, and they came and stung me, and then they stung my wife. And so we thought there's been some dramatic civilizational event that has caused the bees to turn violent, but maybe we're just encountering a different portion of the colony. Obviously,
I mean, that's possible. The Africanized bee is much more violent, so they have a tendency. So if you get too close to them, they have a tendency to sting. I don't know if you have the Africanized bee, which is what people have dubbed, the media has dubbed killer bees.
Yeah.
So because they have a tendency to sting, some of them can be a little bit more violent than others. I just don't know exactly what the situation is with it. So I offered you a drone possibility. I mean, it could be the Africanized bee. It could be starvation. Then once they go through starvation conditions, they get a little ornery and they're more likely to sting, meaning when they have full stomachs, they don't like to sting. So often that is the case. When they swarm, they all fill up their stomachs. The half of the colony, they split. So half of the colony leaves, half of the colony stays, and that's considered swarming season. And then half of them will go off, and their stomachs are all filled. And you can go up to them with your hands and gently grab thousands and thousands of bees in your hand because they are full and they're docile and they do not sting. You go back, if they haven't found a new place for their new home, and in 3 days later, they're now going to sting you. Because they're going to get hungry. They're using, their stomachs are going to be empty. They're going to be more ornery. And so you do have a difference between a honeybee, which is full and content, sitting on the sofa, watching TV, not causing anybody any trouble. And then you've got the ones that are hungry. It's like, give me something to eat. And they become ornery and they become difficult to deal with. That's another possibility. I'm just throwing possibilities at you because I need your scientific mind to sift through what exactly is going on at your house.
Okay. Well, so let me introduce a little bit more data. And then this gets to the sociological question.
Wow, all these big words, Fred.
Well, you may or may not be able to help with the sociological part, but so the bees live here, right? They're in the boxes. You've seen the green boxes, you know, the honeybee boxes. And then the neighbor, he only comes down once every 2 to 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. And so is it possibly to neglect your bees, or do bees need company? Do you need to feed bees?
Generally, no. The only time we feed bees is over the winter. So for those who are dealing with thousands of colonies, they will often feed the bees in the middle of winter. if they do not feel that they're going that they have enough honey to get through the winter. So all of the bees get together in a tight ball, and they start beating their wings, and this produces heat. And this is what they do for several months. This is what gets them through the winter. So that's the only time when beekeepers will actively feed the bees. Other times is maybe when they're introducing a pesticide. So you may have varroa mites, you may have Nosema mites, you may have other problems, and they may put a little bit of a medication in, and they'll artificially feed them that way. But generally speaking, the bees can take care of themselves. So no, you do not need to feed them. You don't need to worry about neglect. They're not missing the beekeeper. They're just doing what they do.
Okay, so
what God has intended them to do, I should say.
Yeah. I got you. And so I shouldn't look down on my neighbor as if he's neglecting his bees, because the last couple times he came, he didn't even like go over and say hi or even look at him. He just walked right by like they're not even there, and I kind of felt
bad. It's okay. Bees can take care of themselves. You're good. He's good. He's a good neighbor. He's a keeper.
All right. Yeah. So that was the sociological question. Should I even bring up the fact that his bees stung me? I'm thinking probably not, because bees, they can sting you, and like that happens.
They can sting you. It happens. The fact that you only got 5 stings is good. It is usually about 1,000 stings that can drop a man.
Okay.
So in case you're wondering, like how many stings can I suffer before I die? And sadly, it wasn't a study. It wasn't funded by the government, but there were a few accidental killings, and the number of stings were counted, and that's where we came across the figure that about, give or take, 1,000 stings will kill a human being. So
okay.
You're at 5. I think you're good. And you're tough. You're tough.
Well, no, I will tell you that approximately 5 bee stings will make a grown man run around and scream like a 6-year-old girl. Because I'm sure that's what I looked like. It was pretty bad.
So is the wife only at 1 sting right now?
She only got stung once, and they didn't leave the stinger. And so that's probably the only thing that kept me from picking up the shotgun, is that they only got her once. Because otherwise, those guys are going to be in trouble. Oh. All right. So I don't know if we've solved the problem of government bureaucracy inserting itself into farming, which to me, that seems grossly communist that the government has anything to do with farming. I would think the farmers could probably take care of that. But what can we do? We're at
the farmers know what to do. We've been doing this for thousands of years. They know how to farm. So they actually know how to do it correctly, too. A lot of them, when I talk during the presentations, they know what I'm talking about. So it's not as if they're saying like, wow, you know, I never thought about that before. They know what I'm talking about and how to turn things around to not only make things healthier, but to make things more profitable. Because right now, due to the unhealthy situations of our crops, farmers are going out of business, and they're going through out of business at a rapid rate. So I'm trying to turn that around in my own little way. And so by turning it into a healthful endeavor, certainly by measuring bricks where you can actually measure it, you can actually make them healthier. We now are going to have less inputs, and when we have less inputs, that means the farmer has more money to put into his back pocket. Because right now, some of them are behind, some of them are breaking even. And for the few that are making profits, the profits are very, very slim. But farming used to be a very profitable endeavor. So why the government feels that they need to step in? Probably because we've been going in the wrong direction. Some of the farmers have been going in the wrong direction, and sad to say, they have been told to go in the wrong direction by certain powers that be. Obviously, I am not in agreement with those powers that be that have told farmers that this is what they need to do in order to raise their crops. Because right now, just over the past few decades, we have had a mess. We have farmers going out of business. We have kids who do not want to take over the family business anymore. They don't want to farm anymore. They're done, so the number of farms are decreasing. We've got problems in our farming system. that wasn't the case a few thousand years ago. We've been farming for a long time. But it's just in the past few decades that we have seen the downfall of farming. And nowhere is it more evident than in Florida, where the citrus industry has dropped off the map, where we've now got a 90% reduction of what it was. So I'm doing my part in order to prevent the wheat growers from getting to that 90% reduction, from the soybean growers from 90% production, from the corn growers from that. So we have reached rock bottom. We are now getting our oranges from Mexico and Brazil in order to give us the orange juice that some of us have in the morning. So it's very clearly on the orange juice bottle, you can see whether it's from Mexico or Brazil, and sometimes they will add it to the oranges, the few that are being made in Florida. So because we've got this situation, someone needs to step forward. I feel I'm just one of those voices, and I need to make sure that my terminology is as precise as possible. And so because I don't like the wishy-washy regenerative agriculture, and I'm more comfortable with nutrient density along with some other things, it is easier for me as a scientist in order to discuss these principles, hopefully in a way which is understandable to everyone involved, especially the farmers.
Yeah, and we covered a lot of that, I think, last year in our show. So we'll link to that show.
Yeah.
We're getting close to being out of time. And just to sum it up, Dr. Dykstra, on what you're telling farmers and the bad advice they're getting, if I recall, a lot of it is overuse of pesticides. They think you have to get rid of insects when insects actually can play a really powerful role in a healthy crop.
That's part of it. Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, that's part of it.
You certainly helped me understand a good bit more than I did before we had this conversation. And that's why
we have noticed. I mean, from a year ago, you were not using four syllable and five syllable words, but now you are just like a new person, Doug.
Well, I appreciate the input that you've had into that progress. And I also want to thank you for helping us understand that what farmers need is more talk between farmers and scientists like you, and fewer bureaucrats trying to organize things from a city far, far away. It's better for a guy like you to go on tour, talk to actual farmers at conventions and meetings where farmers get together and talk to farmers. And that's how we work things out as humans, not as disseminators of human services, whatever those are. And we'll work on a definition for those, and that may be when we have you back, when we launch that official definition of a human service. Dr. Dykstra, we certainly appreciate you being with us, sir. God bless you, and thank you.
God bless you both.
Okay. All right. So for Dr. Thomas Dykstra and my co-host Doug McBurney, I'm Fred Williams of Real Science Radio. May God bless you.